You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening and welcome to the Open Society Institute. I'm Bill Vandenberg from OSI, and we're very pleased that you joined us on what's been a pretty soggy day here in New York. We expect to have a great conversation with you this evening. And this panel called Organizing in the Obama Era is sponsored by OSI's Global Fellowship Program, which is an exciting new program that supports individuals seeking innovative and unconventional approaches to fundamental open society challenges. The fellowship funds work that will enrich public understanding of those challenges and stimulate far-reaching and probing conversations within OSI and the rest of the world. It's a pretty big mission. I will get us started as the moderator here and just say my name is Bill Vandenberg, and after serving as a professional organizer and a racial and economic justice advocate in Colorado for the past 17 years, I now direct a fund at OSI called the Democracy and Power Fund, which funds a range of strategies that we believe will expand and strengthen the movement for social justice in an open society around the United States. These strategies include grassroots and community organizing, nonpartisan voter registration and education, development of paradigm-shifting policies to advance issue change, youth engagement, the develop of a leadership development pipeline, and innovative social engagement through technology and arts and culture, and ways to inspire different participation, new participation in social justice movements. So today's panel on organizing in the Obama era will feature three excellent panelists. They are to my left here, and I'll soon introduce them. And it's really our goal to lift up the field of organizing and the beauty of organizing in this new political moment. And we hope to keep it lively and interactive, participatory, maybe a little bit provocative. Hopefully we'll take on some sacred cows in the social justice organizing ecosystem, and we will have for at least 90 minutes or so an interesting learning community. And we'll begin with a series of questions for the panelists, and then we'll open it up for the final half hour or so for questions and dialogue with you, the audience. So our purpose today with this subject is to weave together and to lift up the many strands of grassroots organizing, broadly defined, particularly because we now have an American president who had a defining life experience through community organizing, that one could make the definite argument that has transformed the way he ran and won the election, and also changed the way he and his administration approached the engagement of people and communities. So, and among these many strands of organizing that you may hear through our conversation this evening will include traditional neighborhood or congregational or institution-based organizing, deep social justice organizing and base building, issue or policy change organizing, online, constituency-based labor and electoral organizing. There are a lot of different strands to this. So in short, it's my hope that we leave here this evening with a renewed dialogue on what it means to organize to change the relations of power in our society in order to advance a more positive and transformative agenda for social justice for generations to come. And since I've never moderated a panel with two-thirds of the panelists with the first names beginning with Z, we'll start the bios in reverse order. So we'll begin with Zephyr Teachout, who's right here.
Great to be first after years.
Great. Exactly. This is transformative. So Zephyr is a visiting assistant professor at Duke Law School, where she teaches election law. She's formerly the national director of the Sunlight Foundation and the director of online organizing for Howard Dean's groundbreaking presidential campaign. After the Dean campaign, Zephyr worked at America Coming Together and Current TV and was a fellow at the Berkman Center at Harvard. And Zephyr co-founded and was the executive director of the Fair Trial Initiative, which supports attorneys working on death penalty cases. And she's also a founding executive director of Baobab's College Labs, a project of Music for America. And she co-edited, in her spare time, a history of the Dean presidential campaign called Mouse Pads, Shoe Leather, and Hope. I like that title. And she's currently working on a book about the anti-corruption roots of the U.S. Constitution. So, wow. Welcome. Our second panelist is Zach Exley. And Zach is an organizer and writer based in Kansas City, Missouri. As a newly selected OSI fellow, he is creating a network of local leaders, organizers, and social service providers in Missouri in order to bring people together who don't normally work together to advance a vision for social change and an agenda for social change. Zach's writing a series of articles about the evolution of the organizing model used by the Obama campaign, and many of you may have seen some of these articles on Huffington Post and other places. They're well circulated and very informative. And Zach will also report through his fellowship on unsung efforts by community and labor organizations that are using many of the same principles and practices of the Obama campaign in their day-to-day work. Zach is a founder of the New Organizing Institute and worked for the Obama campaign as a consultant and researcher. He was online director for the British Labour Party's 2005 campaign, director of online organizing for Carrie Edwards' 2004, but we won't discuss that unless the wine is well distributed throughout the audience. And Zach has also served as the organizing director for MoveOn.org. He served as an advisor to the Dean campaign and spent much of the 90s working as a union organizer. So, wow, again, welcome, Zach. And our final panelist, immediately to my left, is Ai-Jen Poo. And Ai-Jen is the lead organizer and founder of Domestic Workers United, where she works to build power among the New York City metro area's 200,000 largely immigrant women nannies and housekeepers. Domestic Workers United organizes people to win fair pay and legal recognition for domestic workers, and is seeking to win a Domestic Workers Bill of Rights as we speak and in the sausage-making legislative process of Albany. Ai-Jen has 13 years of community organizing and base-building experience and is a leader in the emerging National Domestic Workers Alliance, which has 18 organizations as part of the network working across the country. And personally, I will say that we here at OSI, I've been here about 10 months now, I really consider this to be a very privileged place for us to exist. And we tend to meet the rock stars of the social justice movement, of which we have three here on the panel and many others in the audience. We see the best and the brightest in the social justice movement here in the United States and internationally on a daily basis, a regular basis. And we see a lot of different presentation styles. And I knew that Ai-Jen was a rock star organizer more from what she didn't say than what she did say in a meeting. And when we had an introductory conversation to talk about her organization, she was joined by several leaders from the organization. And this is very rare that a lead staff person for the organization doesn't speak for the first 50 or so minutes of our conversation. And she didn't need to. And that was a true testament to the great organizing work and the leadership development work that she had done with the leaders from her base and from her membership. So I remember that because it's really one of a kind in about 10 months of meetings here at the office. So this is our panel, folks. And we're very excited to have them join us. So let's give them a round of applause before they get started. So the first question will go to everyone, and this is really just give us a brief window on your organizing background and how you came to be here today. You can tell us what you're currently working on, who you're currently working with, and again, in reverse order, how about Zephyr? You want to start us out?
Well, I'm the least experienced of these. This is a great panel to be on of doing day-to-day organizing. I have enormous respect for those who do because, as Zach and I have talked about before, it's incredibly complicated, difficult work to engage people politically and help them find ways to use the political power which they have and may not know that they have. My own experience as an organizer really started with the Dean campaign, where I was the director of online organizing, which sort of is an oxymoron. But most of my job actually ended up being in research and development, working with people like Zach and others, building tools that themselves enabled kinds of organizing that hadn't previously been possible. I think now there's a tendency to sort of fetishize tools, but at the time there were certain steps that we needed to bring certain tools into politics that previously didn't exist, and there's still a lot of those basic tools that sort of like telephone lines or roads are not in organizations that could be otherwise, and I was privileged to be part of some of the early stages of looking at those tools that we could bring into politics. That's part of my background. Right now I'm working with a new organization called A New Way Forward, which is entirely unfunded group demanding temporary nationalization of the banks and long-term antitrust policy where the banks are broken up. And I'm excited to be here tonight in part because we are finding, we're less than 2 months old, there are 40,000 members, and as much as ever since MoveOn, we're allowed to call people members if they sign up on your website and ascribe to your basic principles. Thank you, Zach. And we have had 70 events around the country, and more events are planned for next month. And we are all learning, yet again, how difficult and specific the actual act of organizing is in solving the very particular problems of bringing together particular groups of people. And I'm really eager to learn from this panel other ideas about how to move this particular effort forward.
I started out as a romantic revolutionary, back in high school and college, and I was reading all these, I'd read the history of revolutions and the history of these great social movements, and that's where my head was at. And so if it had been 1919, I would have gone off and, you know, joined a communist cell in a factory somewhere. But it was 1993, and all that was done, and, you know, we had a whole different perspective then. So I, the next best thing was the AFL-CIO said that it was going to restart the CIO. This was 1993, and they, you know, the CIO was this huge organizing movement that where millions of American workers, you know, just were in the streets and were taking over their factories and shops. This incredible movement that was mostly driven by romantic revolutionaries. And so I went through a training program. They gave us rental cars and hotel rooms and scattered us around the country, and but no organizing happened, or I should say very little organizing happened. And eventually the labor movement kind of gave up. So here's one sacred cow, you know, the first one. So the labor movement kind of gave up on organizing effectively. And so they sort of switched over to a strategy of, you know, let's convince a corporation to, you know, agree to make it easier to organize, and maybe, you know, will go easier on them in the contract negotiations. And so we sort of switched over to that model. Again, not the whole labor movement, but big chunks of the labor movement. This was sort of my formational, this is why Bill gave us very strict time requirements, because he knew I was going to be here. And I'm still stuck in 1993, and I have 30 seconds left of my intro. So, but it was it really started me out in thinking about the philosophies of organizing and philosophies of social change. And we were trained in one, and most of us, and including me, brought one to our work from our mostly middle class suburban backgrounds. And it didn't work. And so I got involved, you know, there were lots of people, little experiments that never really took over, to organize along different lines with a different kind of philosophy. And I think we'll have time for me to sort of delve into that a little bit more throughout this talk. So now, fast forwarding to the Obama campaign, this kind of miracle happened in the in neighborhoods in the swing states. If you just went and knocked on doors somewhere, you might not have seen this. You wouldn't have seen this in New York organizing committees. But the Obama campaign actually had this model, very sophisticated model, for putting together teams of leaders in neighborhoods and getting them to go out and do really effective work as organizers. They were doing the same work that on the Kerry campaign staff organizers had done, and now volunteers were doing it. And it was incredible, and it came out of a whole different philosophy of what people were capable of how social change works, of what motivates people. And so we'll be talking about some of that later. But I think that it's an incredibly hopeful thing. That's where my head is at now. Not the Obama campaign, but this thing that happened in these neighborhoods, driven by a subset of people who kind of made their way into the Obama campaign. And it's a great shining example that, you know, of something, a kind of organizing that was happening in lots of other organizations. I think iGen's organization, for example. And so now we get to point to it and say, yeah, see, they won. So, you know, you now let's switch the whole movement over to the kind of organizing that a lot of great organizers have been doing all along.
So, good evening, everyone. How are you? So it's really an honor for me to be here with such a superstar panel, and I've been on another panel that Bill moderated, and I really think that Bill should have his own talk show to be called Bill, like Oprah. I come from a very patriarchal immigrant family, which many of you may be familiar with. And I started out getting involved in domestic violence service work, advocacy, in the Asian community when I was a student. So I volunteered at a domestic violence shelter called the New York Asian Women's Center. And while I learned a lot, I think I really felt the limitations of direct service work and really felt like we needed more systemic approaches, advocacy, organizing, movement building. Where was the movement on the ground that was going to address the root causes of what was happening? And so I started organizing in an organization in the Asian community that was just starting up a project to organize low-wage Asian immigrant women who are working in some of the low-wage service sectors that were growing as a result of some of the factories shutting down and going abroad. And that project became the first project to organize Filipina domestic workers in New York. And that project eventually gave birth through an OSI community fellowship, actually, to a project called Domestic Workers United, which was the first effort to provide a sector-based, workforce-based vehicle for domestic workers across communities to come together to organize, to build their power as a workforce and break that isolation that they face as individual workers scattered in 200,000 houses throughout the metropolitan area, and no one knows who they are, where they are. Well, they come together in DWU to build power, to raise the level of respect and recognition for the work that they do that we believe makes all other work possible here in New York, and to establish fair labor standards and be a part of larger movement building efforts to address the root causes of inequality and injustice.
Thank you, folks. You know, the title of this panel is Organizing the Obama Era, but we won't focus exclusively on the electoral organizing landscape. The next couple questions will explore that theme, though, as that kind of tipped us off. So really for Zephyr and Zach, particularly to start us out, can you look back and share some of your impressions from 2004, 2008 elections, the obvious campaigns that kind of modernized elections in different ways with Dean and Obama, and some of the less obvious campaigns like Huckabee and Ron Paul and maybe McCain? I don't know if that warrants conversation in terms of online presence and that nature. But can you talk to us a little bit about how they engaged people in communities really at a massive scale, and while still giving grassroots activists responsibility and even in some cases autonomy, which is kind of unheard of, I think, in electoral organizing universe. And what did the campaigns do that at the hierarchies of the campaigns, what did they do to allow that to happen or in some cases block that from happening?
Well, that's a lot of questions, but yes. Before talking about the sort of way that I see the campaigns, I'd just like to note November 2008. Is that possible? No, November 2007. What do you think were the two campaigns that had the biggest web traffic?
Presidential campaigns.
Presidential campaigns. Ron Paul and Mike Huckabee. Paul, you may have heard of. Huckabee, you might not know. I would argue that those two, in terms of using the internet to change their relative position in the campaign, had the most effective use, if that's your measure, of the internet. Edwards actually had relatively low traffic. All right, so here's the way that I think about it. There are basically five different kinds of uses of the internet, and we'll focus on that for a second. In the last two presidential campaigns. The question I have when I look at an organization, any kind of organization, be it a campaign or something else, is who has the power and what are the lines of communication? So the first model is the Amway model. In an Amway model, an organizer identifies another organizer who then, or a Tupperware party model, who then holds an event and finds another organizer, who then holds an event and finds another organizer. It's fairly resource intensive, but very effective in terms of bringing in lots of people and engaging them. And at a hyper-local level at the Amway model, there is door-to-door organizing. I see this as the Bush model in 2000 and 2004. And a much more sophisticated version of this is the Obama model in 2008. The second model is basically a church or group model, where the campaign, instead of identifying organizers who then identify other individual organizers, encourages autonomous group activity and then gives general tasks to those groups and asks them to execute them with some training. So there's a long tradition of this in church organizing on the left and right, where churches as groups are given power and basic tasks to perform. power is far more in the community in these models than in the Amway model. So the presidential campaigns that used this kind of church or group model are, besides in recent years, the Dean campaign, the Ron Paul campaign, and the Huckabee campaign. All of those encourage autonomous group activity where groups of people would come together, create videos, hold events, do door knocking, and themselves make strategic local decisions. The third is, I haven't quite come up with a name for this, but it's sort of networking of elites. And the Edwards, I found Edwards a very uncompelling, I don't think he's a very effective politician, so it's hard to separate the effectiveness of a campaign from their use of technologies and structure. But they spent a lot of energy and work networking with both bloggers and leaders of other communities and trying to engage them. So it was sort of elite networking model. The fourth, which I find, the fourth is basically campaigns that tended to fetishize the internet and understand it as something separate from the basic work of the campaign. So they tended to look for more gimmicky efforts, interesting videos to show online, interesting contests, but they weren't fundamentally related to the work of organizing or the work of winning the election. And I would say that both Hillary Clinton and Mitt Romney had a sort of gimmicky, fetishizing use of the internet, where there were lots of fun things that you might complement, but they weren't deeply integrated into the structure of the campaign. And then the fifth is chaos, and that's John McCain. That's a little unfair, but the campaign did switch back and forth from different modes of organizing and of thinking about what kind of candidate he was, and that was actually reflected in their use of the internet. Now, what's exciting to me is that of the first two kinds, both the church or group model and the Amway model, do have a very different vision of what a citizen is capable of than a traditional kind of presidential campaign, and that's what Zach was talking about. I tend to think the long-term cost of having the centralized power that you have in an Amway model is pretty great. That we're going to see the power that came out of the Ron Paul campaign for decades because of those groups of people learning how to act autonomously in ways that you're not going to see coming out of either the sort of Bush or Obama model. But I have more thoughts, but that's the framework.
So I approach when Bill first asked Zephyr and I to be on the panel, he was like kind of hoping that we would clash and disagree because he wanted it to be like the battle of the internet organizer people or something. We met each other on the Dean campaign in the early days before anybody ever heard of Howard Dean, and it was such an incredible moment back then because Dean was going to go on to raise like $30 million online. No politician had ever raised anything online before, really. And nobody knew that was going to happen. It was going to make him the front runner. He was going to organize all these people all over the country. And there was this tiny little group of people on the Dean campaign who were total nobodies, who, had never worked on a campaign before. Some of them had never had a salaried job before, and we were sitting there and this little group of people had some inkling, and each person had a very different view of it, that this something like this could happen. And so, but of course, since we all had slightly different visions of what was going to happen, we had to fight tooth and nail, against each other. And we all loved each other, of course, but we had long arguments about how this was going to play out. And so it's always so cool for us to be talking together because it did play out in a certain way. We were both totally wrong, had to change our minds about everything. And Zephyr, like she, was just talking about one of the variables it sounded like you were focusing on was top down versus bottom up. And so I'm looking at I looked at the Obama campaign and I think that is a very important way to analyze it. But there's another way, which is traditionally this way of organizing that the left has been practicing for several decades, the one that I got trained in the labor movement, has been organizing based on a self-interest model, and where you get the workers in a room together or you get the different community members from different constituencies together and you figure out what's their self-interest that they all will, because that's what motivates us, right? Self-interest. But then this other vision of organizing, which is values and emotion, and a shared vision. And some would argue that that's what has driven social movements, and that's what's driven revolutions, and that self-interest, it's when people step away from their self-interest to do something to, you know, to for everybody else in their society or on the planet, that's when real change starts to happen. And believe it or not, that's what happened in these neighborhood groups with the Obama campaign. And it was actually a deliberate organizing model. And this only took place in, you know, like 8 or 9 states in, you know, in sort of a good fashion. But it was actually a deliberate model. They would bring the volunteer team leaders together, and they would, before that, the paid organizers, and they would go through like a whole day-long or weekend-long training sometimes, teaching, and I'll just give one example of a tactic. There's like 20 other tactics that made this work. They would teach people how to tell their stories. And this is the story of why they wanted to, why they chose to get involved in the campaign to make a difference in the country. And they would actually, they had this whole methodology about it where they would break down their story into the story of self, us, and now. Story of why, what was it in your life that made you come do this? Who's we as a group here? You know, you know when you're talking to your group of volunteers who you've recruited, what story do you tell them that describes all of us together and why we're here together? And then the story of now, why this, you know, the thing we're doing this weekend is really important. And so this storytelling tactic totally changed the dynamic of rooms full of volunteers who had never met each other before. Totally changed the way paid organizers, you know, approached their jobs and approached volunteers. And what was coming out in those stories was a shared vision and shared values. And hearing other people's stories was part of, it was like this magic sort of pixie dust that you know, allowed people to step out of their self-interests. So I'm not throwing that out there as a way to count, you know, against the way Zephyr breaks it down. I think I achieved, I got new appreciation for the bottom-up, for the importance of a sort of purely bottom-up force in a campaign, you know, in the campaigns that have happened since the Dean campaign, where I was saying, send out the emails, get the money, you know. So I think, you know, all these ways of looking at campaigns are really important.
So, Zach, there was a pretty critical article in Washington Post a few weeks ago about OFA, Organizing for America, the kind of new incarnation of where the 13.5 million emails landed after the campaign. And it was critical. It was talking about the federal budget fight and how really OFA had a negligible, if any, impact. They were only able to get like 214,000 signatures out of this massive email list and really didn't have an oomph on the Hill in this. Where do you see the Obama for America activists, especially the more newly engaged or the more online engaged folks, where do you see them landing now? What's your perception of the half-life of a newly inspired Obama activist, and what will it take to keep them connected?
Well, I think there's tons of volunteers out there who just wanted to participate in the campaign, and no matter what you did, they're not going to participate in anything right now. Maybe they would participate in something that comes along next year, but the campaign was the campaign, and now the trick is to create a new campaign. And so, you know, that's OFA's big challenge. For anybody who doesn't know, OFA is the continuation of the Obama campaign, and it's this entity within the Democratic Party that's separate from the Democratic Party, and it has the email list, the 13 million emails and all that stuff, and the database of activists. So that's their trick. If they could create a new campaign, they'd get a ton of the people from the last campaign, but they'd get a ton of new people, and that's the key. In terms of the half-life, I think I'm just guessing probably that some of that thinking in terms of like half-life, like what are we going to do with these people before they fizzle out? We need to reactivate them. And I kind of think that's an old way of thinking that may have been necessary. And partly that get it for the left, for political organizing. And it's still appropriate in a lot of situations, but with, when you have 13 million email addresses, now most of those people were not activists, right? But they're all potential activists. And so when you have, the internet has changed the dynamic, you know, an activist isn't such a sacred, isn't such a scarce commodity anymore for certain kinds of organizations, not all organizations, but for organizations like MoveOn or the OFA. And so suddenly this whole ordeal of having to go out and recruit activists and then keep them engaged and stay in touch with them is eliminated for this particular kind of organization, because if they were able to generate a really meaningful campaign, not a gimmick, but a campaign where they gave people a chance to fulfill all the big ideas they were talking about during the campaign in those groups when they were telling their stories. If they gave people a way to do now what they said they were going to do in their stories after the election, if they could give all those, if they could send out an email that indicated to people in a credible way, now we're actually going to get started on all that cool stuff we talked about back then, they would have this huge wave of old volunteers and new volunteers coming in. And so this half-life question isn't an issue. That's the real issue.
Thank you. Well, recognizing that New York wasn't a presidential battleground state last year, iGen, like Colorado or North Carolina or Ohio, places like that, how did you feel the presence of Obama-inspired activism last year? And, you know, how did your members, who are particularly immigrant women, how did they connect to the whole phenomenon and the reality of the inspiration of the campaign?
Well, it was a really important campaign for our members, and people were really engaged. I've never seen anything like it in terms of political engagement from the immigrant community. People were following it every day and giving each other updates, and I think that and it was really surprising in a lot of ways, because this workforce is a pretty cynical bunch. People, when you go out in the parks and playgrounds, half the people will say to you, yes, we need a union, finally, where have you been all my life? And the other half will be like, it's been like this since slavery, and you're not going to change anything. It's been like this for hundreds of years. And so there's a lot of just cynicism, and organizing isn't necessarily popular. And so although that's changing, hopefully, we like to believe. And so I think that what this campaign did for people was actually, it was more what it symbolized. And it symbolized a different kind of hope and possibility. And it symbolized, it popularized the idea of change and social engagement. I mean, a lot of the themes of the campaign were really affirming to the workers who were out there in the parks and the playgrounds trying to organize other workers and having such a hard time over the years. Actually, it created a different context for the organizing that they wanted to do, and more people could identify with the idea that, yeah, actually we need to organize, and change is possible, and we need it. And a lot of the messages around service and getting involved and unity, all of those things actually shifted the ground that people then organized within in this industry. And I mean, people are still wearing their Obama buttons on their hats and to the meetings. And it's really, I mean, I think what it symbolized was just so much in terms of people's sense of what was possible.
Thank you. So we have a ringer for the next question. It was submitted to us online by someone out of the D.C. area named Walter Davis, who is the executive director of a group called the National Organizers Alliance. And I'm going to ask Zephyr to wade into this one. And Walter asks, President Obama's campaign brought many new people into organizing. Now the electoral campaign has merged into the Democratic Party. In turn, Organizing for America has been created to support the president's policies. Walter asks, is there a risk to community organizations when a policy campaign is run as an extension of the party in power? Are grassroots communities going to have a role in setting the agenda, or are they locked only into the parameters of the discussion allowed by the White House and the Congress? And he cites an example, I guess, that happened in this last week or so, where it's an example of these possible contradictions when single-payer healthcare advocates were frozen out of a congressional hearing. And so he closes with a pretty compelling line, which is, can we still speak truth to power, or are we asked to be a silent partner? What do you think?
I think Organizing for America is strategically flawed in its conception and democratically flawed in its conception. So the basic idea, as it currently exists, is that 13 million inspiring, newly civically competent people are going to take messages from Obama as Obama, not as the Democratic Party, and support his agenda. I'm on the Organizing for America list. It regularly encourages influencing members of Congress to support the Obama agenda. The most recent, you've hit on something I feel very strongly about, needless to say. The most recent set of emails suggested they were going to do a listening tour, which has its own interesting genealogy. When somebody tells you they're going to listen, it's always a little dangerous. anyway, but they wanted to listen not about what was happening in people's neighborhoods and what was important to them, but rather listen to people's ideas about how to make organizing for America a more powerful tool. At a most basic level, if successful, this is a 13 million person email list from the president, the least responsive branch, a president who I deeply admire, but the least responsive, least representative branch against the most representative branches of government, the state houses and members of Congress. So this is the goal of Organizing for America. Luckily, I don't think it's going to work, even though they have fantastic organizers for a bunch of reasons. I think it might work if Obama was a demagogue. He's not. But no, we are not stuck with that at all. Though we still have lots of channels of power, only stuck if we accept the frame that Organizing for America gives. So I would encourage organizers to go to those listening meetings and say, I don't want to talk about how to make Obama more effective. I want to talk about bankruptcy. There are channels that are set up, not just through the internet, but in other ways. And the important thing is this, I mean, this is what organizing is, as I understand it, is helping people recognize the channels of power which they don't know that they have. There are more channels of power now, and Organizing for America as a parallel channel to the Democratic Party, I think, is a flawed structure, but can be used as a place to demand more and should not be used in the way that it was designed. I think the most exciting things during the campaign were when groups of activists actually protested using Obama's own tools against his policies on spying, because it showed that there was that his step, which is a really important one, is to recognize people's is to help people recognize their own civic power, can then be used against him, and that will show the success of his own message when that works.
Anybody else like to weigh in on this one?
Well, just real quick, I would take issue with that is that I agree with everything that Zephyr just said, except that OFA is not a party. Even if it was, it sort of is the Democratic Party, but our parties aren't democratic organizations. OFA is not part of our democracy. It's an organization, and so it is what it is. And so I also hear the silent scream that Zephyr hears of this amazing, you know, organization with all this potential. Just kind of, you know, if it was a social movement, then what it would be turning into right now would be something really beautiful. But it wasn't. It was the email list and the network of activists who were working to elect a candidate. And so the real issue is, so what's stopping us from going out and building a social movement that also has a, you know, 30 million, you know, or a 300 million person list, you know, and what's stopping us from doing that? And I think actually that some answers lie in the presidential campaign, because the Obama campaign, every presidential campaign has certain things built into it by the moment that give it sort of the juice of a social movement. Even on the Kerry campaign, we, you know, now it sounds like nothing, but we raised, like $125 million online for Kerry. It was half his budget. So this even the Kerry campaign had these elements of this enormous volunteer outpouring. You know, the offices were just jam-packed with volunteers who were turning out in response to emails and phone calls and stuff. And so there's a date, right? There's something that actually matters. Who's going to be the president of this country that has all these bombs and, you know, likes to invade other countries and stuff and tortures people? You know, there was an issue on the table. We can stop all that if we elect this guy, whatever else he does. And there was a hard deadline, and you had to win or lose, and so people had to take risks the way you have to in a social movement. So it was all those elements were built in, and we need to replicate those outside in a real social movement. We have to stop being kind of lazy and, you know, hoping that a presidential campaign will be our social movement and then stay a social movement. That'll never happen. And like you said with the demagogue thing, when it does happen, we should be really worried. you know. So, and I think there's a OSI fellow in here who's done, in the room, who's done some research on this in totalitarian countries and use of the internet in organizing.
Thank you, folks. We're going to shift gears a little bit, and this next question is primarily for iGen to take first cut at. And that is, you organize primarily in a more traditional, very labor-intensive, and mostly offline way. And really impressively, you have 2,300 members that you've identified and your colleagues have identified from working in parks and playgrounds and outside of private schools, where really that you take your members take care of the children or the homes of New York City's elite, or at least the very comfortable residents of the city. And I'm wondering what your take on online organizing is, and will it ever be relevant to your membership base and to lower income communities, people of color communities? You know, there's somewhat of a generational split in terms of access and online participation, but in other communities, immigrant communities as well, that have lacked access and influence in politics. What's your take on that?
I think it's absolutely relevant and really an important vehicle. Anytime you're trying to impact change at the level that we're talking about today, I think it's absolutely critical that you use. I had a mentor named Richie Perez, who was an activist here in the city for many years, and he always used to say, any and all tactics, as an organizing principle, any and all tactics. And I think that the online organizing has really, a really good example of how it would relate to our work, for example, is the work of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Are you familiar with their work?
Share a little bit more.
So the Coalition of Immokalee Workers is an organization of farm workers in South Florida that has taken on many of the multinational fast food corporations and won in battles against them for higher wages for tomato pickers in Florida, taken on Taco Bell, McDonald's, Subway, I believe, Whole Foods, and won. And they've mounted amazing national campaigns that are about very local conditions in South Florida, in the fields, picking tomatoes. And they've done that largely through an incredible coalition and an incredible broad base of support that they've built largely through the internet, in terms of being able to project out the local conditions, the stories of workers, the day-to-day lives, and then actually have it speak to and reach just a range of people, and largely students, and an entire movement of students that now has an organization that's national called the Student Farm Worker Alliance, formed in solidarity with this organization, and they're now engaged in international work around farm worker rights. And it's been amazing what the internet has helped propel in terms of a projection of a very local struggle. And I think we've tried to do that in some ways with our statewide campaign for a Domestic Workers Bill of Rights here in New York, in terms of reaching populations, unlikely allies, people who might find us through the internet but not be able to find us any other way, who might care about this issue for any number of reasons, having been raised by a domestic worker or having a grandmother who is a domestic worker. And you'll find that President Sweeney, the president of the AFL-CIO's mother, was a domestic worker for 40 years. And he never would have connected with us if we hadn't gone through certain channels. But there's a million people out there who could relate to our issue if there was a pathway to do that. And the internet provides that. And online organizing provides that. And so we're sort of just starting to develop that capacity to really organize in that way. But I think that the Coalition of Immokalee Workers example really shows the enormous potential of it.
My former organization in Colorado was the host organization for the former Taco Bell customers of Colorado as part of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. And, you know, it was easy in Colorado. There's great Mexican food. You don't need Taco Bell. It makes you sick anyway. But, you know, we organized effectively and kind of looked like there was an economic impact for the corporation. And it was part of that campaign. So great props. So, Zach, you have a lot of experience working with online efforts to engage different communities. What do you see as common mistakes or missteps that online groups do when attempting to engage communities?
Well, I mean, I wish I knew of a good example of an online organization that was, you know, reaching past the constituency of people who started it, and which, you know, so you know, I worked at MoveOn.org when it was kind of just getting started out, and you know, those of us working on staff, it was like five people. We were all remarkably similar in our class background and, you know, ethnicity, and I could say identical actually, and so what do you think? You know, how do you think the MoveOn membership, you know, turned out? And I actually think it's really important, though, sort of another topic, that there are organizations that that organize that, you know, my constituency, my people. You know, I want to organize my people to you know, be better people and take America in a better direction. But it's, you know, it's really, so I think, you know, the key has got to be that, you know, it's going to be a working class organization that does good working class, that does good online organizing. And, it's got to be, organizations of color that reach out to communities of color. And there are a couple of good examples. There's, Color of Change, which a guy named James Rucker kind of left, he came in to MoveOn for about 10 minutes and then left. And started, you know, an organization that's actually done some really interesting campaigns and has built up an organization. Also, like, you know, the NAACP they jumped on that Jenna 6 moment and did a petition, and they brought in hundreds of thousands of members in this one moment. So now they've got a constituency of people online to work with. So I think there are going to be more and more examples of that. I heard of a few examples, you know, of like nurses organizing in SEIU, using email and using the internet. I heard of a couple examples like that, but they tended not to take off. Like, they didn't, as far as I know, they didn't like spread throughout the labor movement. And I don't have any real good theories about why that is, but yeah, so it's hard. I mean, a big issue obviously is internet access too. Like, when I first, you know, when I missed the first like 5 years of the internet, even though I was a computer geek when I was a kid, because I had been like living in these Motel 6s as a union organizer. And when I finally came back and got, you know, connected and was like, wow, this internet thing is cool. And people were starting to talk about this. Will the internet create democracy? Will it be a tool that people can use? And I said, no way, because I never saw a computer once, you know, in any of the, you know, thousands of workers' homes that I had, you know, visited in the 90s, right? But you know, I think now that would be different. And I think, you know, if the UAW was, you know, fighting right now and, you know, reacting to this, you know, to the elimination of the U.S. auto industry, they would be able to organize their membership online because those folks have computers and they use them.
Zephyr, some might make the case that online organizing actually opens up a more participatory and less hierarchical organizing culture than that of, you know, traditional, more old-school, institution-based organizing groups and networks. How would you assess the state of internal democracy and participatory decision-making at groups like either big online groups or smaller ones, but groups along the lines of MoveOn or Avaaz, more of an international type of a MoveOn, or other groups?
Oh, wow. I guess I do think that there is there was a time where it was really important to talk about, and maybe it still exists, to talk about internet organizing as a separate matter. But iGen's model of trying anything and everything assumes that there's a purpose separate from the purpose of growth. And I think a lot of the online organizations or organizations that understand themselves as internet organizations have sort of become subject to the tyranny of numbers that leads them to talk very much in terms of growth without purpose necessarily, but growth to show strength, growth to show support. The harvesting of membership becomes a little bit closer to polling in some way. There's language which suggests if we have 13 million members and you have 10, then maybe we actually have more support, which isn't true. I mean, these are not actually good proxies for support. And the focus on purpose is really important. When it comes to the big online organizations, so I guess I reject the category that online organization is sort of a coherent category. The question is, what is an organization? What does it do? What is it set out to do? Should I support it? And does it, there's only The only question is it an organization which foolishly ignores some of the tools that it might be able to take advantage of, like foolishly doesn't use the roads, the phone, or the internet? And then you might ask those questions. I mean, if you want to get into the weeds on Move On, I don't actually have anything that thoughtful to say about Move On.
Do you want to lead the sacred cow up? No.
I think Move On has done a lot of really important things and made people feel like political change is possible and different kinds of political expression are possible. I don't think that one of the things it does best is internal democratic governance, but that doesn't mean it doesn't serve a really worthwhile role.
What does internal democracy look like for the Domestic Workers Union or Domestic Workers United?
There's a book about SNCC that's called Democracy is an Endless Meeting. no, just kidding. we do have a lot of meetings, and they tend to be very long. but we have what we call a member-driven organizing model, where basically all the work is led, shaped, and carried out by the members in member-led committees. And so for every area of work, whether it's campaigns or base building or research or culture, media, there's a committee of members who's working on it, shaping the work, identifying the goals. And it's overseen by a steering committee of domestic workers. And there's an intentional strategy to constantly bring in new domestic workers into different leadership roles. And that involves training and workshops and exposure to other kinds of organizations and other organizing, participation in conferences. And so we invest a lot in a real intentional leadership development strategy for everybody. We believe that everybody in the organization has the potential to lead and that leadership looks a million different ways and that it's important to really cultivate leadership from the bottom up. And yeah, I think we do end up in long processes sometimes over things that, I would often prefer not take so long. But at the end of the day, when people feel part of the process, as you know, they feel ownership over the work in the organization and accountable to the goals in a way that's very different. So we do prioritize that.
Thank you. A couple more questions, and then we'll open it up for folks in the audience. And kind of shifting gears here too, some might say that this time is full of maybe the cruelest of cruel ironies, right? We have great opportunities to advance political change. We have this crushing economic context that we exist in. And the question to iGen to start would be, how is this economic moment opening up new opportunities for organizing for social change or social justice or more progressive policy advancement? And then also, what's the landscape like for smaller, more grassroots organizations who are kind of struggling to keep the doors open these days?
So in June of 2007, this amazing gathering took place in Atlanta, Georgia. How many people know what I'm talking about? Oh, man.
A few hands in the audience.
The U.S. Social Forum. And, that forum was the sort of culmination of about 10 years of 1,000 flowers blooming in local communities around the country, community organizing efforts like ours here in New York that have sort of evolved over the last decade. And in 2007, those organizations came together and organized what was one of the largest gatherings of the social justice movement in this country for a long time. And 12,000 people showed up in Atlanta to attend hundreds of workshops, what felt like thousands, and plenaries. And it was a moment where everybody's issues and everybody's sectors and campaigns actually came together and converged in one location. And that was before the economic crisis. I think that there was a sense that this is the time, even before the economic crisis, this is the time for us to actually come together as a movement. The banner was, another world is possible, another U.S. is necessary. And I think that the idea was that we need to bring everybody together. with no clear agenda, but to bring everybody together and see what we have, and see where we unite, and try to start imagining a stronger, more coordinated, more intentionally strategic movement that had momentum at the grassroots level. Fast forward, the elections happen and all these other forces are in motion and there's this a new climate around social change. And Obama wins and there's all these new opportunities for real systemic policy change, a real change. And actually, we don't even know the limits of what that will look like yet because we have yet to fully test it. And at the same time, this economic crisis, and I think that the framework of an economic recovery or even a stimulus package, for example, lends itself to the integration and breaking down of the barriers between the different sectors and silos with which we've done our work over the last 10 years. So whether you do work around police brutality or whether you do work around tenants' rights or workers' rights, we've often done it in a silo, and this moment of economic crisis actually lends itself to an integration and people actually working, connecting the dots across issues and coming up with a comprehensive vision for a different economy that actually works for the majority of working people, if not all, right? So this is a moment where we can actually imagine and dream bigger than ever. And I think that it actually lends itself to movement building, to integration, to connecting the dots so that we can be bigger than the sum total of our little parts in our local communities. The challenge is that a lot of our organizations have not actually had the experience of doing work at the national level, of impacting national policy debates at that level. We don't have policy shops in D.C. We don't, so it's all new terrain. And at the same time, the economic crisis is really doing away with a lot of the funding that, or threatening the funding of a lot of grassroots organizations, particularly the smaller scale organizations that actually do the work at the front lines of this crisis. And so there's a contraction of resources and an opening of possibilities. So a lot of organizations are in this position of having to stretch and having to form new alliances, find new friends, unlikely allies, and enter into new collaborations and stretch beyond our comfort zone. And I think that that's a really good thing. At the same time, I think we have to be really mindful and make sure that the organizations at the grassroots level can survive and thrive, because that's really the ground, the core, and the heart and soul of what's going to be real change in the future, I think. So that's sort of where, and for us, we're involved in a process called the Inter-Alliance Dialogue, where we're getting together with a lot of the grassroots alliances that have just emerged coming out of the social forum at the national level to try to actually put together a real grassroots agenda for economic recovery. And next Tuesday, we're bringing together domestic workers and day laborers and low-income tenants and homeowners facing foreclosures and people who are at the front lines of this crisis to actually hold a briefing with the Congressional Progressive Caucus to start talking about economic recovery from the bottom up and what would be a vision that would actually make an economy that would work for all of us.
Thank you. Our last question for the panel before we open it up is, what is currently inspiring you? What current organizing efforts do you see out there that are just making your eyes light up or that you feel great hope for, either that you're participating in or that you see in your travels around the neighborhood, around the country? I mean, these could be new alliances, like what iGen just mentioned with the Inter-Alliance Dialogue. It could be just noticing more values-rooted work instead of transactional approaches to organizing, better integration of short-term, long-term strategies, online, offline integration, visionary politics. What do you think? What's inspiring you at this time?
Jen's story about how she recruits leaders was very inspiring, and that kind of focus and that kind of work in that organization. You know that's the key, I think. And there are a handful of of organizations, I think, that that are intentional and do that, and those, when I catch glimpses of those, that's the most inspiring thing. And, again, there was this sort of brief flash that happened in so many neighborhoods around the Obama campaign of a similar strategy. And right now, the most inspiring thing I'm watching is in Kansas City. There's at least four different little networks around different issues that emerged from the Obama campaign. And, you know, the organizers just pulled out. You know, they were gone. And these teams, they didn't even necessarily have, you know, the method of getting them all connected to each other was at the victory party. They were swapping numbers and email addresses, you know, because the teams mostly worked in their own neighborhoods. They'd see each other at trainings, but there wasn't a formal system for having them all connected. But they got connected anyways, and, you know, I think they're hampered, you know, by not having a more formal connection to each other, but they're doing some amazing work, and there have been all these community meetings around the schools. There's a campaign called B1, which is a mentorship program that a lot of Obama folks are working on. There's another it's called Hands On, and it's, again, for the schools. It's trying to get all these citizens, just families, to just go into the schools and get involved and reform them, help them. And a couple others that are going on, and people just use, they don't have the Obama organizing suite of tools. They have, you know, Google Groups and, you know, little things like that, and just their inboxes. And so that's a really inspiring thing, I don't know how long they'll last, right? Because there is that need, I think, for both the bottom up and the top down. It's not that it's not the top down part that's the important thing, but what that top down dynamic in the Obama campaign brought was a model, there was a process, you know, that actually worked, you know, that had worked somewhere else, and it was being introduced to this new community, and there were people whose job it was, you know, 24 hours a day, really, to keep that model going, right, and to teach people on that model, and that constant infusion, you know, kept it going at a whole different level that's not happening now. So I'm afraid for those kinds of organizations.
I really appreciate the Kansas City reference too, because I think this is something that, as a national and even international funder here at OSI, we tend to disproportionately support organizations just by nature of the density of organizations or the access that people have. We disproportionately support organizations that are in New York and D.C. And there's a big old country out there beyond the Hudson River, right? And we are looking at ways that we can better support work that's happening in the states or at the local level in a complementary strategy to national level advocacy and national level organizations. So glad that you brought that example up. Zephyr, would you like to share?
I'm also inspired, as critical as I sometimes am, but I'm deeply inspired by the people who are newly civically competent, some fraction of whom are then taking that new understanding to try to influence political power. And so it's in electoral campaigns, primary campaigns, in areas that might have seemed overly gerrymandered, where groups of people are bringing primary or threatening primary challenges and taking the information which they now have about how power works and actually trying to make that work. So in Durham, North Carolina, where I live, I suppose we're most inspired by the people that we see. I'm inspired by people who come out of the wake of the Obama campaign, thinking about running for hyper-local offices and then also contacting their Congress members on a regular basis. And they haven't quite figured out how to do it, but those early steps give me some hope that out of that 13 million, there's 100,000 that are going to figure out how to work our most representative branch. I am generally, though, I think we're in a really tough time, and something that isn't often talked about is the way in which organizing technologies are not just benefiting the many, but also make it far easier for elites to coordinate, not in big online move-on-like campaigns, but it's much easier to coordinate messaging and strategic decisions among groups of 15 as well as it is among groups of 1,500. And that's just something to be thinking of.
Thank you. Ajahn?
Well, I wouldn't be a good organizer if I didn't talk about the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights campaign right now for a second. But I think it's actually relevant because 6 years ago, 250 domestic workers got together in the auditorium of SEIU Local 32BJ and came up with a platform, which was their vision for what it would mean to be recognized and respected as a real workforce, and took that platform to the NYU Immigrant Rights Law Clinic, who then turned it into legislation, statewide legislation. And then they, every month for the last 5 years, every single month have traveled, domestic workers have traveled to Albany to tell their stories. And 5 years later, we are going to hopefully, knock on wood, the Senate Majority Leader just committed to bringing the full bill to the floor for a vote in the next 2 weeks. So we hope that that will happen. But we still need to really secure the support in the assembly, and we need to secure the support of the governor. Now, if this bill passes, it will mean 200,000 domestic workers will receive notice of termination, severance pay, paid holidays, protection from discrimination, 40-hour overtime after 40 hours of work, which is never been the case, and you know domestic workers work long hours, and a day of rest, at least a day of rest per week, and essentially respect and recognition as real workers. So it's actually a pretty significant campaign, and so we're on the verge of this really important climactic moment in the campaign, and so we're going to be planning a series of actually a week-long 24-hour vigil where domestic workers are going to hold vigil in front of the Legislative Office Building in Albany and in front of City Hall for an entire week, 24/7, from June 8th to June 14th. And we really hope that each and every one of you will come out with donuts and coffee in the mornings or what have you in the evenings and just show your support. I mean, this is just a really, it's a campaign that's actually involved thousands of people over the last 5 years, and it's sort of at this moment of truth. So it's an inspiring campaign to me because it's involved so many employers, union members, students, the children of domestic workers, the children that they take care of. It's been a really inspiring campaign in that way, and it's going to be a pretty big win that is a model for the type of sort of bold policy that we can try to push at the national level, hopefully, to create a new economy.
So you've all mentioned some great examples. Would you like to list some websites for people to check out, or how can people access or get connected to the things that you're talking about?
DomesticWorkersUnited.org.
Well, I'd like people to join anewwayforward.org. It's focused on breaking up the banks.
I don't know. I mean, I'm blanking on good sites that you can check out, but I can always make a pitch for something I wrote recently. And you, if you want to read more about that Obama team model and get some more texture on that, I wrote a thing that's up on the Huffington Post that you'd probably enjoy if any of this has interested you.
Let's open it up. Questions, comments, discussion from the audience. To the mic, is that Francis that I see in the background? If you could introduce yourself.
My name is Francis Kuhnreiter. I'm from a group called the Building Movement Project. And first of all, I just want to thank the panelists. This was just a fabulous panel. You always think you know a lot, and then you come to something like this, and you realize you know so little. So my question is, it's kind of the question that Bill asked on the economic recession, and I was very appreciative of how we say that numbers are not everything, and we know Theda Skocpol wrote this great article many years ago called "Advocates Without Members," talking about how you can have a financial membership, which many people did in the Obama campaign, but that doesn't mean that they're members that you can turn into real advocates, that the elites were doing the advocacy. We're finding across the country with the people we know that the smaller groups are really, as Bill mentioned, not only suffering, but they're kind of going out of business. And there seems to be some sort of logic that the bigger is better, and that that everything has to go to scale now, and if you're not at scale during this period, that you really don't have anything to offer, that this is a moment, and this is where the resources need to go. And I think there's some truth to that, and there's some not truth to that, and I would just be curious your reactions to that. And I fear we're at a moment where we may lose many on-the-ground organizations because they can't sell themselves in that way. And the final thing I want to say is that I think there's a kind of a social Darwinism going on, that if you're not funded, that means you weren't a good organization, and if you are funded, that means you're a great organization. So I just wanted your comments on that.
Actually, before you jump in, we'll give you a 15-second interlude here. Francis, you want to cite a book that you and a couple other folks just wrote on kind of leadership, transition, generational change within organizations? It's a good book, and folks should check it out.
My colleagues Helen Kim and Robbie Rodriguez and I wrote a book called Working Across Generations about nonprofit leadership, especially in social change organizations. Thanks, Bill.
A quick hit on that. I think that oftentimes the social justice arena is described as an ecosystem, and I think that that's really helpful in relationship to your question, where actually it is a very diverse and dynamic ecosystem where each type of organization has a really important role that it plays, and without it, things get off balance. And I think that the real local organizations that do deep leadership development but maybe aren't mobilizing thousands of people but do work that's at the front lines and highlighting issues, struggles, communities, like I think that without that part of the ecosystem, things become really off balance. So I think it's really important that we not just think in terms of scale in that way, but we also think in terms of depth of work and ability for organization for that ecosystem to continue to exist.
Well, obviously, there's a lot of discussion about the value of economies of scale in the financial market sector. A colleague of mine, Lawrence Baxter, just wrote on Baseline Scenario a piece about some of the fallacies of economies of scale. Lawrence Baxter. This is in the financial sector. I think some of that applies in any sector, that there are sort of assumptions about scale. Now, that doesn't mean that big is always bad, or that one should always invest in small, but that you should be aware of not favoring one, and there are reasons to think that it actually might lead to inefficiencies and the creation of bureaucracies. I mean, his argument is basically that what one would expect, that there's sort of a tendency to bureaucratization in some of the large organizations. Something to look at.
You guys have said it all. I won't. We'll get more questions, yeah.
Over here? We actually need you to step to the mic, if you don't mind, since we are taping. Thank you. And what's your name when you get to the mic?
I'm Prue Brown. I've been working in community development, community change. I am curious of how you think about the traditional organizing groups, PICO and IAF and so forth, and how they relate to the things we've talked about today. And also, whether you see the landscape as one that benefits from lots of different kinds of organizing, not necessarily coordinated in any way, or potential connections among groups.
Just jargon alert, PICO and IAF are national interfaith or congregation institution-based organizing networks. They have local chapters, and then they aggregate at the national level.
I mean, I think that the work that the PICO network has done and IAF has done has just been really important and really sort of that we all as organizers are trained in the methods that they've developed over time, and they've set up infrastructure and institutions and actually had real impact in local politics. And now PICO nationally, I think, is really engaged at the national level in policy work. I would like for there to be, I believe that it doesn't make sense for us to continue to do things in a dispersed way, that the energy that exists, there's enough unity and agreement around certain principles of equity and justice that we can actually do much more in a coordinated fashion than we are and win much more than we are for everyday people. And that's the kind of, I think, that's the next level that we need to get to is that constellation of groups, we all need to figure out how we coordinate strategically, intentionally, at a much bigger scale than we ever have in order to create the conditions for the kind of change that Obama talked about.
Yeah, I agree, and I think, like, what, you know, the story that Ijen told earlier about her organization's strategy around the Bill of Rights, this the vigil, you're never leaving, right, and just all the strategizing that went into that, and for 5 years, you've been going up to Albany for 5 years, right? Well, if we did that, you know, and by we, I mean, you know, if any combination of those groups and the throw Move On in, you know, throw in, you know, some unions, you know, and there are these efforts to get all these organizations, there's various efforts to get all these organizations together, and they come up with a little label, and they, you know, get a logo and all this stuff, and they put a bunch of money in a pot, and some of these, this, you know, happens every couple of years or every election cycle. It's happening now, but I would sort of venture that there's something, like, if we got together and said, you know, and did that same thing and put something down on the table, these are the reforms that need to be passed. And, you know, to be strategic, you could do exactly the same thing and say, these are just the obvious things, you know, that we need. I mean, there was $150 billion. Remember when the $150 billion was in the stimulus bill for education? And then it got taken out. So it's like, we're going to give you $150 billion for the schools. Oh, no, we're not. And where do you remember any outcry over that? Do you remember, like, labor unions and Move-Ons and you know, and all these organizations just screaming, getting on TV, running ads about that? And that's just one little thing, right? I mean, our government is taking literally trillions of dollars that we're going to have to pay back and that our kids are going to have to pay back, and making decisions about what they're going to be working to pay back. So what are we doing with this money that they're going to be toiling to you know, and making sacrifices, cutting other things to pay back? And they're basically giving it to bankers, right? And I know it's a little more complicated than that, but there are trillions of dollars just being totally wasted, right? And so if there was, so just imagine if we did that kind of strategy, you know, and put something on the table right now, rallied around it. And so there's something kind of fundamentally wrong with the progressive movement, that these groups that are coming together, another sacred cow, are, you know, from what I understand, and I don't understand that much, but just from what I see, they're just saying, let's support, you know, whatever Obama's doing. Obama doesn't want that, right? Obama doesn't want that. Obama wants to be pushed. He's walking a tightrope, and that tightrope has, you know, he can't move the tightrope. And so I wish that was happening right now. I really, really do. And it's a shame that it's going to take us another 4 years until an epiphany happens, and, you know, and that does start to happen.
We have a number of folks stacked up in the queue. This gentleman with the blue shirt.
Can I just...
The one that's turning around, you. So if folks could maybe follow this gentleman to the microphone if you want to ask a question. We are going to cut it off at 8, but we want to take as many questions rapid fire as we can for the next 20 minutes. So please join us at the mic. Let us know your name. We'll introduce yourself, and we'll keep it moving.
Hi, my name's Chris Johnson, and I remember... listening during the Republican convention when Rudolph Giuliani got up and ridiculed Obama for being a community organizer, and what's a community organizer. And in the next couple of days and weeks, listening to the outrage from the left, like, how can you be so disrespectful to this man and to this work and to the great work that community organizers do? And as a community organizer, I was more outraged by that response than I was for Giuliani. I mean, I knew Giuliani was a jerk, and so I wasn't surprised. I'd worked on issues against him and stuff like that, and I knew he knew what community organizers were and what they did, because community organizers around police brutality and a number of issues made his life miserable. So he knew what community organizers were. But for a community organizer, particularly for a community organizer who'd worked in predominantly white organizations and powerful organizations that went into communities that were predominantly people of color, and some organizations who from time to time would talk to this idea about community empowerment and the importance of really building inside of community and not just going in there with, you know, we know everything, and if you just listen to us, things will be perfect for you, and then seeing that not really always work out that way, I was wondering, with this forum in particular, this panel, whether you guys would address that type of issue. I mean, as community organizing now in the Obama era, how does this change? How do we change this dynamic? Did you see it? Do you see it changing in the future? Do you? I mean, I'm interested in the stuff that you're talking about at the online level. It's so important, stuff like that. But I want to know, as community organizing at a time when so many communities are watching their safety nets dissolve around them, how are we going to be more effective? How do we really build community? How do we really honor community organizers? And how do you see that changing now in this era? Will it be any different now because we have a president, or because you guys or some people started to ignite communities? Because what I heard, particularly from you, it doesn't lead me to believe that if what we're saying is, like, you know, the shelf life isn't important, there'll be another new group of people because we can send out email blasts that may excite people. But that doesn't seem like it's any movement building. And it doesn't seem like it's really empowering, particularly to poor communities and communities of color.
Let's give one of as many folks have an opportunity to ask questions as possible. So rapid fire thoughts, please.
Okay. Do you have a pen?
Thank you, Chris.
Write some of them down. Write
Here's a pen.
What I'd like to see is a lot more. This is a specific as opposed to a general answer, because the questions you ask, I think, are unanswerable. They're ones we're all going to be answering together. I'd like to see a lot more, in terms of the use of the internet, use the internet to bring people together in regular events in hyper-local communities all the time in groups, as opposed to individual meetings, and across IAF, other organizations coming together, because that repeat show is where we're going to find our new leaders. There is a real admiration for Obama, though, that I think there is a real opportunity for more, for a change in the way that we think and talk about that.
Well, and just real quick on your point about the email, the leaders, it's you're right, but I was talking about a specific situation where if you have an organization, the way OFA kind of does, and then if you have this 13 million person email list, then it just makes the work of recruiting new volunteers to come in and, you know, take the place of ones that cycle out. It just makes it a little bit easier. That's my only point. If it doesn't help communities of color, if there's no email list of you know, people of color in those communities, it doesn't help working class communities. So I was just talking about this one specific tactical thing that applies to the Obama campaign.
Hi, Jen.
Just really quick, I think that organizing is always going to be hard. I mean, the nature of organizing is hard, and I think that what can facilitate better, stronger organizing is us actually taking the best and leaving the rest, right? Taking stuff that's been developed over the years in organizing and then innovating new methods and new approaches. And there's a trend, or not a trend, but a growing cohort of organizers who talk about something called transformative organizing that really looks at the process of how we transform ourselves as organizers along with the social transformation that we're trying to achieve in the world, and to be able to actually work much more effectively and in a way that is much more expansive and hopefully enables us to sustain as organizers over the long term in a different way. So we could talk more about that later, but I think it's like learn the best lessons from the past and innovate new ways of organizing.
We're going to change this up at this point. Peter will be our next questioner, but we're going to take a stack of maybe three questions, and each panelist is not going to answer each question unless it's particularly contentious and interesting or dynamic. Or
you have to hurl insults at us to give us the personal point.
So let's get rolling then. So Peter, would you mind your name and question, then we'll keep it moving.
Peter Hardy, Pushback Network. Democracy is indeed an endless meeting. I'm convinced of that. Class has sort of poked its head up a little bit in the conversation, the digital divide, the privilege of organizers, college educated, the voices of those voices we haven't heard, poor working class communities of color. Have we seen any shifts there? Were the privilege of class, where the organizing in working class and poor communities, did the campaigns see what was going on in IGEN's organization? Was there linkage there? Were there lessons there? Or are we still sort of whispering about privilege and not really sort of tackling it?
Thank you, Peter. Let's keep moving.
Okay. With all these, Nathan Newman with Progressive States Network. I mean, with all, lots of things could react to, but I'm going to ask a question which is for decades of doing various kinds of organizing, different work, the question is always, what about the folks who don't want to organize and be organized? I mean, the endless meeting, Oscar Wilde once said, I'd be a socialist, but it takes too many evenings.
And I'm we had this debate on TPM Cafe. Yeah. Ah,
so I will throw this question out. Which is the question I've always had, because there is a core, as organizers, of wanting to find other people who want to come to the endless meeting with us and who want to be talking at 8 p.m. on a Thursday night rather than being home with our children talking about organizing. And the question is...
It's how we killed the left.
Right, but...
Sorry.
But most of the models of organizing, the talk about it, how to get more people to come to the meeting, how to get people out. And for a lot of people, the reason they were excited about Obama is he'd get elected and they could go home. You know, and that's, I think, a lot of the context. It's not that they organize, and we see this as an opportunity for the next step, but there is this real challenge, I think, for, and, you know, having been at meetings, I used to describe the anarchist meetings I went to
I think we have enough of a question that we can have a response in a second, not to be disrespectful, but let's take a couple more questions and then we'll sink our teeth into it. Thank you.
My name is Ted Perlmutter. I teach a course on globalizing activism at New York University. I wanted to add a quick note on the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. The other trick that they did very well, aside from online organizing, was that they went to these big demonstrations of farm workers, they videotaped them, they put them on VHS, and they went to the trailer camps, and they showed them to people, and that was the narrative that they did to empower people. And I do have a question, and it sort of relates to a story that was told to me by an old Italian organizer, and he said, well, and they were saying, why do you guys, you know, sort of wait, and he was a union organizer, why do you pay so much attention to these crazy kids? He said, well, the reason is that you don't know when the next wave of militancy is going to come along, so you don't know when the next sort of generation of folks is going to be there. Zach has suggested, I think maybe I'm making more of it than what he had intended, that this is no longer the scarce item. You know, that attention span, that ability to get people out is no longer the scarce item. What is the scarce item in your take on these things at this point?
Thank you. One more?
Hi, I'm Peg Byron. I work in public relations, not as an organizer, so this is kind of naively raised, but I am interested in how PR can be a tool in advocacy. And I just want to raise an issue that really has to do with content and a couple of examples that you might comment on. One is, for example, with Zach, when you talked about the team model and people telling their stories, I wondered if that contributed to that sense, that kind of chameleon kind of quality Obama sort of had in a way where people projected whatever they thought was their issue is what he supported. I mean, so it was never maybe clarified or hammered out with him what he was actually supporting. It was their story. And along the same lines, having done a few things with Move On and gone to Ohio and frustrated with that, but it struck me that what happened with Move On, you know, subsequently was, you know, like their emails started to annoy me because I didn't always agree with what they were doing or their technique, but it seemed like they lost content. And that's sort of what I see, you know, as a kind of theme here. One of the themes here is, like, in terms of what is, if you're going to motivate people to go to meetings or whatever, what's the content? What, you know, what's the motivational, you know, reason for it? You know, like, in, whether beyond opposing Obama, you know, doing a little thing that we don't like.
Thank you, Peg. We're going to, the folks in line, we may yet get to you if we have quick responses from the panel. So how about one person per question? We have digital divide, class issues. We have what about people who don't want to be organized, the scarcity model, and communication as a tool for advocacy. Yep.
Quick.
Content, thank you.
Just a quick hit that kind of speaks to a bunch of stuff is I think Maya Angelou once said that people don't remember what you say, they remember how you make them feel. And I think that that's the key. If you have a long meeting, if it's a boring long meeting, right, but if it's a space of inspiration and sharing and hope, I think that that's very different. So it's not so much about the length of things, but I think about the character of what you're bringing people into, whether it's online or it's a physical space or it's a meeting, whatever it may be. If it's something that makes people feel possibility, hope, inspiration, I think that that's really key.
I Yeah, I read that book about SNCC and then there's another a new one, you know, that goes, I forget what it's called, but I think some people say the long meetings killed SNCC, but I agree with exactly what you're saying, and I don't think it was the long meetings that killed SNCC. It was, I'm going to try and answer two questions at once here. It was this influx of basically middle class people, and then, you know, and also an influx of middle class white people who came in and just totally disturbed this culture that had kind of been gelling, you know, among the staff, which there were upper middle class white people in the original core group of SNCC, and
acronym watch, Zach, for folks who didn't grow up in this country, weren't around at that time.
Yes, sorry. It's a civil rights organization.
Student
Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, yeah. And so it was really, you know, amazing kind of key organization in the civil rights movement. And then you see that that's what I saw in, so this is going to be my Sister Soulja moment, and I'll use Nathan as Sister Soulja. That it's that we've got something wrong with our culture, and we kill organizing even among our own constituency when we try to organize them. But we're really good at just like bringing down a room, you know, and just introducing this like negativity and tediousness into every organizing meeting. And I saw that in the unions. I got to visit all these little, you know, hamlets of organizing in the Obama campaign, and I saw that a little bit in some. But they managed to avoid it because they had in the suburbs and in the rural communities, they had the young organizers were culturally very similar to the people they were organizing. But in the cities, it was kind of I'm trying to come up with a better metaphor, but it was a crapshoot, I think is the right expression. In Kansas City, the people who happened to get, the guy who happened to get hired to be the regional field director for Kansas City was an African-American guy who'd been a community organizer and a policeman before that for 10 years. And he hired all these African-American and Latino organizers who are also from Kansas City, and that's why all this stuff is flowering now. And he would have these meetings, and I'm not saying he did this because he was African American, but I or you would not have had meetings like this. He'd get up and do like this church service the night before a big thing. It was like a mock church service. I mean, they were making fun of a church service, and people had so much fun, you know, and everybody went along with it. It was awesome, and so. So I'll just stop there.
Zephyr, care to weigh in for a minute or two?
Go ahead.
Any other thoughts on any of these questions? Shall we take another couple?
I think the class question is one of the biggest ones. I think there's perversely some hope in the Tea Party protests because it shows... there's a lot to be said about that, but there is a deep populist anger in this country which is not productively directed. But it suggests that people are willing to do something about it.
For those who don't find your questions getting answered, you can talk to the panel after as well, as long as they're willing to stick around. Patricia.
Hi, Patricia Gerardo from OSI, and I want to pick up on that and also the PR question. My question is around what you're seeing in terms of new framing and the fact that with the economic crisis that we have now, there's been a huge transformation in American culture, and we're no longer considering ourselves consumers. And that has been such a big impact on how many groups have done their work. We call our, you know, constituency consumers. You know, it's really framed it. And with the populist backlash against business and banks and how they've let us down, how are you seeing organizing taking advantage of this opening to move the conversation to a different way that's less business model and more, you know, whatever transformation you're seeing?
Jason.
It's Jason Cooper, Pushback Network. My question is more looking inwards, and I'm curious as to your thoughts about assessing our impact as a field, that field being organizing. We have new tricks and, you know, new technology that we use that makes our work easier and increases the scale in which we can operate. But I'm I'm interested in your thoughts of, are we really doing our work better in terms of our impact in our communities? Are we really having greater impact now than we did 20 years ago? And kind of as a follow-up, we get caught up in the numbers, how big is our base, the actual policy wins, whether it's electoral or what happens at the state house. Are there other indicators? What's our matrices of success, or what's the new one that we should be having moving into this time?
We've got about 5.5 minutes to go to do justice to some pretty meaty questions, so I'm afraid that might have been the last question. So, folks, can you jump in? Quick thoughts? New framing?
That guy was standing right there. Can you ask a question real quick? You're standing there the whole time.
I know Scott from way back. He'll be cool. No, I'm from my Colorado days. So,
okay.
So let's jump in, folks. New framing, populism, looking inwards, assessing our impact.
I don't know if this is not an answer at all. It's something I'd like to see more of. I think there are a bunch of people who share these interests in economic issues and believe that there's a moment. The history of coalitions is fraught. It's very difficult to work in a coalition for a lot of reasons. This is actually returning to your question. I'd like to see a lot more use of simply communicating without agreeing, so that progressive organizations across the board who have similar, like NCRC and SEIU, and 10 other organizations who are working on banking issues, simply talking every day, to at least have that level of coordination instead of what often tends to be a much bigger leap to demanding people to sign on. That and a lot more both lean strategic efforts around policy issues and then funding, very quick funding of experimental efforts.
I agree with that. And I think that we can do a lot more than we're doing if we don't push for long-term marriages, but just because you can't really marry somebody off of a first date, right? So if we actually work together or communicate more for longer periods of time around common issues, shared interests, then and actually engage in real stuff that we're moving forward, I think we can get a lot more done on that front. I think that we do in one other way. It's not. I don't think it's just about electoral campaigns. Or just in response to your question, I think that there's like amazing symbolic acts of resistance that happen that we can actually capitalize off of more or utilize more as opportunities to organize than we have. An example of this is a group of workers in Chicago in a factory called the Republic Windows and Doors Factory that occupied their factory and took on Bank of America and won. And I think that that was one very local, one-shot campaign, but it symbolized so much of what American workers are struggling with and what people are afraid of. And it actually inspired a lot of hope in people, and Obama paid attention to it and actually supported the workers' efforts, right? So I think that kind of action and the symbolic nature of it has the potential to also spark more if we're able as organizers to really build off of these moments and try to capture them within a larger strategy.
So thank you to Jason, Patricia, Peg, Ted, Nathan, Peter, Chris, Prue, and Francis for your questions. Thanks for the dating advice, too, iGen. Thanks to our great panel and to all of you for joining us this evening. I want to send a special thanks to the OSI Fellowship Program for putting together the forum, and this will soon appear on www.soros.org if you'd like to refer it to friends. So thanks very much. Thanks again to our panel.